Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
It's hard to argue against the Pittsburgh Steelers' defense of the 1970s as being the greatest in the history of pro football. During a six-year span, this group's dominance was crucial in helping the franchise to four Super Bowl victories. The Steel Curtain also featured four members of the Pro Football Hall of Fame, including Jack Ham, whose road to NFL stardom started not too far from Pittsburgh. He grew up in Johnstown and eventually attended Penn State beginning in 1967, where he would be led by a 40-year-old head coach in his second season, Joe Paterno. Jack, what stood out about Coach Paterno? What did you notice playing for him those 4 years that gave you an indication he would not necessarily be at Penn State for so long, but would be a great coach?
Well, I obviously did not realize it when you're a freshman in college and you're just trying to find your way around and try to, you know, make a football team and get some playing time. So what I guess I admired most about it, it almost seemed like he was cloned because, in that time you had two practice fields, defenses on one field, the offense is on the other, and he is not up in a tower overseeing everything. He is hands-on on the field and, you know, going back and forth from offensive field to defensive field. And we had a running back named Fran Gannon who ended up coaching for Joe Paterno for a number of years as an offensive coordinator. He made a mistake on a running play, and Joe saw that from about 50 yards away and came running up to our drill and running up to Fran Gannon and correcting him right there. And I think that was the first example I'd have of how stickler to detail he is. This was a practice, obviously, and he saw that mistake all the way on half the football field away, and that's the way Joe was. He would, you know, he always felt that you could be well prepared, do all those little things right in practice, and you know, in doing the games, the big things will take care of themselves. And I did not realize he was going to be at Penn State that long a period of time. And one more thing about how I felt about Joe Paterno. He, when I was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame, he was my presenter in Canton, and he was my number one choice, and I really didn't have a number two.
In your four seasons with Penn State, from 67 through 71, Nittany Lions' record was 37-5-1, including consecutive unbeaten seasons in 68 and 69. Unfortunately, no national championships to show for it. 69 was especially tough, not only the second straight 11-0 season, but that was the year, I believe, when President Richard Nixon declared Texas number one after they beat Arkansas. Being an independent on the East Coast probably had a lot to do with it. But how disrespected did you and the players and the coaches feel when your teams weren't given the same amount of credit and respect as, say, a Notre Dame, a Texas, or any other national power?
Well, you go back to where Joe Paterno, he was trying to put Penn State on a map. A lot of times back then, people confused the University of Pennsylvania and Philadelphia with Penn State. And Joe Paterno gave Penn State an identity, and you're right about our undefeated season. We ended up being number two in the country both years. And we don't have a playoff like we have here today, which I think is a great thing, a 14 playoff. But I don't think we're self-disrespected. I think the fact that we're building a program there at Penn State, and they eventually got their national championship down the road. We really didn't feel that disrespect that you're talking about during that period of time. I think to a man, we thought we had a great football team. On the defensive side, I thought we could play with anybody. We had some really tough games in the Orange Bowl in two consecutive years. So I don't think disrespected. I just think that was the start of building a program at Penn State, which went on for many, many years.
You would go on to be drafted by the Pittsburgh Steelers in the second round of the 1971 draft. As mentioned earlier, growing up in Johnstown, you probably followed the Steelers intently, but the Steelers were a franchise, as many probably don't remember, that almost never made the playoffs and were often under 500. So that being said, certainly playing in the NFL is a dream, and playing for the local team is great as well. But were you any bit fearful of possibly going into a no-win situation with a franchise like Pittsburgh?
I was, because even as a young kid, I really wasn't much of a Pittsburgh Steelers fan. My father and I, that's when the AFL was having a wide open, throwing the ball all over the place, 40 games, and the NFL, the more traditional league, was more of a 3 yard and a cloud of dust and very conservative in their play. So, I didn't think I actually was going to get drafted by Pittsburgh, because the day before that, the New York Giants called me in the San Diego Chargers, and they said they were going to draft me in the first round. Well, I was naive enough to believe those guys. Looking back on it now, it couldn't have turned out any better for me. The opportunity to play, go up to Johnstown, like you said, go to Penn State to Pittsburgh, and I was concerned about how the team had been playing and the history they had here in Pittsburgh, but obviously the draft, the 1971 and the 74 draft, I think were two drafts that really put Pittsburgh into a championship-type football team.
And Chuck Knoll would be your coach starting out, and would be your coach for the entirety of your pro career. Was the transition from Paterno to Knoll an easy one for you? Did they have a lot of similarities in the way they coached?
They had a lot of similarities. Chuck was more business-like in a sense. He ran his football team like he was the CEO of a company, and very stickler to detail, reading a lot about Chuck after the fact, books written about him. He enjoyed that training camp. The training camp at the time where he loved teaching. He loved the training camp 2 days where he would make sure a guy who he knew was going to get cut probably next couple of days, but still work on him with technique and trying to do the right things. And in that sense, they were very similar. But Joe was much more emotional in college, and Chuck was more the business-like coach in pros. Both did it their own special way, and both were very successful.
How do you think Chuck Knoll would fare today as a head coach, especially with the differing type of personalities and attitudes?
Well, I think Chuck, people say you're stuck in the way you always coach, but I think he would have adapted. We adapted in the sense when we won our first two Super Bowls, we won with a great defense, a running game, and play action pass with Bradshaw. And then, when the rules opened up for the offense, we won our last two Super Bowls, putting up 30 points or more by throwing the football so much. So, he would have adapted to that. Chuck was he was not just a football coach. He was a very smart guy, and I think he would have been able to, whatever the era may have been, I think Chuck Knoll would have been very successful in being a head football coach.
The initial step in making the Steel Curtain what it would be from a personnel standpoint came with the drafting of Joe Green in 1969, one of four Steeler defenders from that era, and you being among them, to be eventually inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. How did Green's presence in that lineup at defensive lineman impact the defense altogether?
Well, I think if you talk of one guy who kind of just was the poster child of our football team, it was Joe Green. I mean, he was, set the tone where, we played a tough physical game. Joe was one of the few guys back then who was 275, 280 pounds, who was very athletic, could run sideline to sideline, and he could also overwhelm an offensive lineman. He had that type of ability. But he also was a great leader for our football team. Like, he set the tone a lot of times on the defensive side of the ball. And then when we went to our defensive stunt 4-3, where he had to take almost double teams on every play, he bought into that because it made our defense better and made it a championship-type defense that could win a Super Bowl. So I've got the most admiration of any player on our football team. It would be Joe Green, and he is... You talk about a real Steeler. I mean, he was the guy who set the tone even before Bradshaw.
Yeah, one of only two Steelers to have his number retired. And while Green was the most notable of that front four, there was also L.C. Greenwood, Dwight White, Ernie Holmes. Collectively, their ability to rush the quarterback and put pressure on the quarterback, what freedoms did that generate, not only for yourself, but the other linebackers, along with Mel Blount and the defensive backs?
Oh, it was huge. I mean, you're right. It was not just Joe Green. I mean, there was a couple of years where Ernie Holmes just was absolutely dominating from the other tackle position. L.C. Greenwood played in front of me. He was more athletic and quick. You know, used to do it with quickness. And Dwight White was kind of the combination of all of that. And, you win the championships and you have a good defense because your front four is a dominant front four. And that's what we had. There's no question. I played behind one of the best front fours in NFL history. And we could get the pass rush with four linemen. If we blitzed because we wanted to give a changeup. It wasn't blitzing because we had to blitz to get pressure on a quarterback. Our front four did an outstanding job of getting that pressure and allowed me to get into the passing game in our secondary. And our secondary knew the ball would be out of hand to the quarterback very quickly as well, and played that way. So that's, the defense set that tone, defensive front four especially, and we were able to play aggressively in that secondary because of our front four.
A player you played right next to for 9 seasons was middle linebacker and fellow Hall of Famer Jack Lambert, a classic overachiever and the embodiment of intimidation and toughness. What was his off-field persona like compared to his on-field demeanor?
Well, a lot of times people say that players, he's that aggressive kind of guy on the field, but off the field he's really different. Now, Lambert was the same no matter what the case, on or off the field. And part of about me was that Jack Lambert. Most people don't really realize. Is how smart he was. I mean, 1974, he was the middle linebacker calling all the fronts for our front four that we talked about, all the secondary coverages, changing those coverages as well. And he was a rookie middle linebacker that went all the way and won a Super Bowl. There's a lot of responsibility. As much as I admire the aggressiveness and the great, great player that Jack Lambert was, I admire how smart he was because you don't come out of college and coming into the pros, a lot of times you're just trying to find your way. And we had a good football team, and he ended up being the glue finally to make us a great football team on the defensive side. But I don't think many people realize how smart Jack Lambert was, and that's the thing that set him apart and what made him such an outstanding middle linebacker.
We're going to run it. On the draw, woo, down there, Tony Dorsett, hit by Jack Ham, who many call the best outside linebacker in pro football.
The two All-Pros, Jack Lambert and Jack Ham, are absolutely awesome.
You talk about smarts. You were often lauded, praised not just for your intelligence, but also your quickness, which helped you in defending the run as well as the pass. Did you find one skill more important than the other when it came to being a great outside linebacker?
Well, no, it doesn't. For me, not great outside linebacker is being able to be good at both things. Because as a linebacker, you've got to be a big part of the running game and even a big part of the passing game as well, especially in a 4-3 defense. You're going to be involved with the tight end, the back out of the backfield, and all those things. So you never want to be a liability because then third down and long, they're going to take you off the field and bring in either another safety or whatever the case may be because you're a liability. That's why I admire guys like Jack Lambert who could play the run and the pass equally as well. They could play man-to-man coverage or zone coverage out there. It's a guy like Ray Lewis who a couple of years ago retired who could do that as well. And it's not just a great big hit you may make it, the line of scrimmage, everybody, you know, oohs and ahs about it. It's to, you know, to be a complete linebacker, you got to be very good at the passing game. That's why guys like Ray Lewis and Jack Lambert in the middle, they kind of set themselves apart from other than the linebackers because they can play so well in the passing game.
Getting all that talent on defense and then all the stars on offense, Terry Bradshaw and Franco Harris especially, it all came together for the Steelers with the division title in 1972, the first playoff victory coming by way of the Immaculate Reception against the Oakland Raiders. But the 1974 season resulted in the team's first championship, winning Super Bowl IX over the Vikings 16-6, in which Minnesota was held to just 119 yards of total offense. As much as it was a thrill for the players to win it for themselves, there must have been an even greater joy in winning it for the man who was there from the very beginning, founder and owner Art Rooney.
Well, you're exactly right. When people ask me which was my favorite Super Bowl, and without question, it was our first one. To be able to put it all together, and like I said, that was the draft. 1974, we ended up getting Lynn Swann and Jack Lambert, John Stallworth, and Mike Webster, all Pro Bowl guys, all Hall of Fame guys who really put our football team over the top. But you're right. I mean, Pittsburgh always had that reputation of being a, you know, a team that was tough, hard-nosed, would always lose games in the fourth quarter. They kind of changed that reputation by, you know, getting Franco in 1972, starting that, where you won a couple of playoff games and finally put it together in 1974. But you're right. It was because I can still to this day see at that time Commissioner Pete Rozelle giving the Lombardi Trophy to Art Rooney Sr. And in typical Art Rooney Sr. fashion, all he said, his acceptance speech was thank you. And yeah, it was in our locker room at Tulane Stadium. And it's not just me. I think most of the players on that football team, that was one where you're winning it to the chief, and that was his nickname throughout our town here in Pittsburgh and throughout the NFL, and that was special. That was special, and the other Super Bowls were great, but they pale by comparison to the Chiefs getting that Lombardi Trophy.
We're down now to 15 seconds to go. The Steeler fans counting it off. The Vikings trying to line up. An awesome physical team were the Steelers today. Up goes Harris, Joe Green, Pittsburgh, the Super Bowl chance. Chuck Knowles up there. Pittsburgh wins it 16-6. Chuck Knowles being carried off. They were about the worst team in pro football when he took over. They rebuilt by the draft, not by trading. They made every number one and two pick count. They're still a very young team. I would say their best years are ahead of them.
He's such a beloved icon in Pittsburgh, even to this day, partly for the way he treated his players. How did he foster such strong relationships there?
Well, I think number one, you know, that was a rap on the Chief back then. He was too nice to his players. He wasn't tough enough on them. And then when he did end up getting a coach like Chuck Knoll to come in here and kind of righted the ship here. And not that he was not tough in negotiations, but you were, he had his financial manager, who was Jim Boston at the time, who did a lot of the contract negotiations, still were tough in that sense. But you always had that respect for Art Rooney Sr. He had that cigar in his mouth, and he had stories about the track when he would be betting back when, and then I would go to his lunch with him in the off season at the restaurant inside the stadium, and he would recall those stories to me at time to time with my wife and I would go to lunch with him, and just fascinating stories, and you know, it just felt like a family here in Pittsburgh, and that's exactly where a lot of players felt about Art Rooney Sr. And it was special, but in the same game, he was tough. He was tough as well in the negotiating side of it. But it was a respect that we had. It was very, very special.
So often, that Steelers team of the 70s that went on to win four Super Bowls in a six-year span gets compared to other dynasties of other eras. Looking at today's landscape, the dynasty now, if you will, would be the New England Patriots. Maybe it's impossible to gauge with all the rule changes that have occurred, but how do you feel your team, and your defense especially, would stack up against Brady, Belichick, and New England?
Well, Well, first things first, I think, you know, we talk about different eras. It's so much more difficult today because, to be very candid, if our football team had ended up in this era, we would not have been able, after two Super Bowls, to keep that football team together. There would have been salary cap issues. And obviously, we didn't have that kind of a freedom in pro football back then. And the turnover now is so incredible in the sense that you're trying to hold your core people together before, you know, you lose them free agency. I think, you know, I will stand by what we did during our era and how the game was played then. And I'm sure New England and right now the Denver Broncos, after they won their championship as well. But it's very difficult to compare eras. It's so much more wide open today, the passing game and the rule changes. The rule changes began in during my career, and they are just taking even that much further for the offense. So tough to compare eras, but I'll stand by the guys that I played with back then as being one of the best football teams in the NFL.
So looking at that era, the 1970s, there were many great teams and outstanding offenses. In the AFC and in the league, you had the Raiders with Ken Stabler at quarterback, the Don Shula Miami Dolphins with Bob Greasy and Larry Zonka, the Houston Oilers in the latter part of the decade with Earl Campbell. Was there an offense that your group had the most trouble getting a handle on?
Well, I think the team that probably gave us the toughest time during that era was the Oakland Raiders. Had we been in different conferences back then, I think the Oakland Raiders and Steelers would have been playing for a lot of Super Bowls. But since we were in the same conference, we went up against the Raiders a lot of times. We were able to win a couple against them in the AFC Championship. Our first one was in Oakland to win the AFC Championship and then go on to the Super Bowl against Minnesota. I think the challenge of playing the Raiders with Ken Stabler and that whole crew, their offensive line, was a great challenge for us, and to be honest with you, the Super Bowls are great, and you end up winning them, you know, so that's the important game. But I had the most fun I had playing professional football was when we you know, ended up playing the Raiders, and normally it's a playoff or championship game, and that was the most fun I had in pro football, playing those Oakland Raider Pittsburgh Steelers games.
Soon after retiring from the NFL, you embarked on a broadcasting career, becoming a commentator for NFL broadcasts and eventually your current role as an analyst for Penn State. When you first made the transition from player to broadcaster, what was the greatest challenge you faced? What did you find most difficult about it?
Well, the biggest challenge I faced, I think, was number one, when I went on to a pro career, and I went on in business here in Pittsburgh, and I came back and started my broadcasting at Penn State, and the head coach was still the guy who coached me way back when in the late 60s and early 70s. So Joe Paterno was still there, and it wasn't really difficult, but, you know, you have to be, you know, honest on your critique, whether it's good or bad. And I remember Joe telling me one time, yeah, you got to do what you've always done and be yourself. That's why we hired you to be the color analyst at Penn State. And, it wasn't difficult for me, but it was kind of, you know, to see being a broadcast, it almost made me feel like I went full circle by going off from college and the pro career and the business career and coming back, and Joe Paterno was still there. But it was an easy transition. Steve Jones, who I worked with through the play-by-play, makes it very, very easy for me, and it's something I really enjoy, it's good to be involved with the Penn State program up there.
You talk about coming there when Joe Paterno was still around. All that went down at Penn State in the past few years has been well documented, and more information will arise in the years to come, but a lot was made about Joe Paterno's involvement with the program. Outsiders would say, you know, the game was passing him by and that he was out of touch even before the major news of November 2011 broke. As you said, you were someone that was with him very closely at the early portion of his head coaching career, and you were there in Happy Valley at the end. Did you get any indication that those criticisms were true?
Well, the idea of Joe continuing to coach and whether he should have stepped down a couple of years earlier or not, I mean, I watched him out in that practice field, that spring practice. I remember when they were talking about as the game passed by, he was out there on an onside. He was demonstrating the onside kick and actually kind of pulled a hamstring during that period of practice in spring ball. So he was still the hands-on guy. And that's what I remember when I played for him and how I mentioned how hands-on he was on both fields all over the place. He was still the same thing then when I was up there doing the broadcasting as well. For the Sandusky thing, the NCAA handled that, I think the worst possible way. That was a criminal case, and that's the way it should have been. Joe Paterno's program up there at Penn State is second to none. He cares about education. He cares about those guys going on, and not so much in football, but into their life's work. And so, whether he stayed, there'll be critics to the point that have said that he stayed too long. All I know is that he was hands-on to the day he was done.
Testaverde with both backs in the block, throws, and it is intercepted. Conlon to the five. Four interceptions for Penn State, two for Conlon.
You are certainly part of a great tradition of linebackers at Penn State. Since your time playing there, we've seen many great ones. Shane Conlon, LeVar Arrington, Paul Posluszny, just to name a few. Is there one that stands out, especially one maybe during your time in the broadcasting booth, that stands out above the rest in terms of impact to the program?
Well, I really can't say one, but the part of the broadcasting when I watch a freshman, like a Paul Posluszny, come as a freshman and just trying to, again, reacting a little bit, not reacting quick enough on plays, and just watching a guy like Paul develop and just each year get better and better and better and just end up being just an outstanding linebacker. I like the fact that I was watching him from his freshman season all the way through until his senior year and seeing how he developed. Those are the kind of things. Shane Conlon was a great, great player on a national championship team, and what a great group of guys on that team as well. It's hard to pick one. Deshaun Lee now with the Dallas Cowboys was an incredible player. All these guys, one thing they had in common, they're all smart guys, too. They're smart in the classroom, but they're also football smart as well. And guys like Conlon, guys like Posluszny, guys like Sean Lee, it was great to see their careers blossom to the way they have.
In the wake of all the sanctions levied against the program, the team would be coached first by Bill O'Brien for two seasons, and now, for the past 2 years, by James Franklin, who arrived with a lot of confidence after some success at Vanderbilt. So far, a pair of 7-6 seasons. Has he satisfied your expectations up to this point?
He has more than satisfied my expectations. When you have sanctions like that, it doesn't hurt you next year. It's like in the NFL, if you draft you have a bad first-round pick or second-round pick in a year, it doesn't hurt you next year. It hurts you 2 or 3 years down the road when you get that void. And that's what's happening right now with James Franklin. He's weathered that storm right now. They're back this year now, back finally to full 85 scholarships, and now we're on the level playing field as well. Now, James Franklin is doing a great job. He's an outstanding recruiter here, but it takes time to get that program back after the sanctions. And I think Bill O'Brien did a great job for those 2 years. We needed a guy like that, and I give him all the accolades for what he was able to do. But James Franklin has to weather that storm as well here right now, and I think he's done an outstanding job. And the arrow is pointing up for that Penn State program.
In addition to the other accolades we've mentioned, Ham is a member of the NFL's 75th anniversary team, the College Football Hall of Fame, and just recently, in recognition of the golden anniversary of the Super Bowl, he was placed on the game's all-time team. A great thanks to Jack Ham for joining us. Hope you enjoyed this edition of Profiles in Sports.